So this morning I'd like to talk about equanimity. And equanimity is a very important mental state or attitude in the Buddhist tradition. It's an argument can be made that it's an important attitude in many of the major religions of the world. They have a place of honor for equanimity. And it's something which we're probably all familiar with in some degree or other. Sometimes aware of it by the absence of it, and wish we had some more. And sometimes we're more familiar than we realize, in that probably there's many times in life where you're relatively equanimous about things, and you're not even aware that that you're equanimous. You're not aware that you're being non-reactive and not caught by it, not hooked by it. Your buttons are not being pushed because you've gotten used to this state. But maybe 20 years ago, if you remember how it was, you would probably remember that. There were a lot of things that really perturbed your mind, agitated your mind, and now it doesn't agitate you in the same way. When people think about equanimity as a form of Buddhist practice, there's sometimes some reactions to it that it is maybe not so interesting. People are a little bit aversive to equanimity, in that equanimity might seem to be a flat state, kind of a indifferent state, a kind of place where there's not much passion or interest or excitement about life, and why would anybody want to just be flat? And so hopefully that's not what it's meant. And what I want to do is talk a little bit about how the Buddha talked about equanimity as a way of helping you reflect on it. Maybe this week you can reflect on it, make it a theme of contemplation, of exploration for the week. For the one-day sitting we did yesterday, at the beginning of the sitting of the day, I encourage people to look at the issue of equanimity, in particular to look at how they weren't equanimous. Situations that arose where the mind was reactive or caught or agitated by what was going on, and to study that, because one of the ways of developing any ideal in Buddhism is to study what gets in the way of it, rather than going for it directly. And the word equanimity is an English word, of course. It comes from Latin. And it might not be the best translation of the Pali words for equanimity. And also the fact that equanimity is a usual translation belies the fact that there are a number of different Pali words that are used for, that are translated as equanimity into English. But in Pali, they see it as different words. And so the nuances of differences might be missed. The most common word, and also I just want to say, in English, the word equanimity is interesting because it comes from the Latin word, something like, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but aqueous plus animus. And aqueous means even. And animus means, that's which animates the spirit, animates the being, the life, the spirit within us. So it's an even, balanced spirit, even, balanced psyche, or inner life with what goes on. The two main words in Buddhism that are understood, translated into English as equanimity, are upekkha and a long word called tatra majja tata. And upekkha is relatively well known because it's one of the four brahmaviharas, one of the four divine abodes that is a meditation practice that people cultivate. People cultivate meditation on loving kindness, meditation on compassion, meditation on sympathetic joy, and then meditation on upekkha, on equanimity. And as a brahmavihara, as one of these divine abodes, they can be understood as a form of love. So each of the brahmaviharas is a form of love. Loving kindness is obviously that, but the other three also, including equanimity. And most people don't think of equanimity as a form of love. So it's a little bit, seems a little bit strange. Sometimes it's likened to having a grandmotherly mind. The archetype of the grandmother, at least, is someone who has a lot of love for the grandchildren, but has a relative equanimity about the grandchildren compared to the parents, especially first-time parents, where, the kid trips and starts crying, or the kid, you know, whatever. And they're right there and, you know, so concerned and worried about every little thing and the meaning of everything and how this little scrape is going to affect the rest of their life. And the grandmother, has seen it all before, and baby cries, and, you know, she meets the baby with lots of love, but isn't so caught up in the drama of it, doesn't make a drama of it. There's a kind of equanimity. So I don't know if I described it well, but some of you are grandmothers, perhaps, and you can describe it better. But, you know, this the love of equanimity is likened to a grandmotherly mind, the love of a grandmother who is balanced and seen it all and is kind of can be relaxed about it all, not caught by the various drama. The word upekka comes from a root that has in its heart of the root the word to see. It means literally something to see toward, or sometimes it's understood to see with patience. It's kind of a colloquial use of the word upekka. Iksha is a Sanskrit root to see. And there's a difference between looking and seeing. Looking, it said, just to kind of, just we look around. But to see is a little more active. We really see something for what it is. You can look, but then you really see deeply. And there's a lot of words in Buddhism that honor the role of seeing. And we have it in vipassana, the insight. And we have sight in the word insight. Vipassana, it comes from the word passana, which means to see. Or we have the word darshana, which also means to see, or kind of a seeing, a vision. Knowledge, enlightenment sometimes is called the knowledge and vision of liberation. So the idea of seeing is very important in the tradition. And so what are the ways in which we can see an experience, see ourselves, see others, so that we have some equanimity about that situation? Is there some new perspective that we can bring? And I think that explains a little bit about the background of equanimity, that involves a little bit of partly what it involves is a perspective that allows us to see a situation so we're not caught in the drama of it. The second word that's translated as equanimity is this longer word, tatra majja tata. And it's just a simple kind of word strung together as a compound. Tatra is a simple Pali word for saying there, just there. But sometimes in a more general sense, it can mean all this or all of this, the situation here. And majja is the same word as the Majjhima Nikaya, which means middle, just the word for middle. And tata is the same word as the end of Satipatthana, and it means to stand or to pose. So to put those three together, to stand in the middle of all this. It's understood to being in the middle, it's understood to be balanced. So to have a kind of balance in the middle of all this, what's happening, whatever's happening, to be balanced. And the image I have is that of a seesaw that's balanced perfectly on its pivot. And so it just doesn't, you know, just balance there. But as soon as you have more weight on one end of the seesaw than the other, it tips down and the other goes up, becomes imbalanced. And so are there situations in life where we get tipped one direction or the other? So that tipped over the edge, or pushed over the edge is the expression in English. We get pushed, that pushed me over the edge, we say. That was just too much. And so then we go berserk. Or we do something. Something happens to us. And we get caught by it, or we get depressed or discouraged or something in some very dramatic way. And it's said there's a lot of things which can kind of polar extremes which tend to push the mind around, agitate the mind, oscillate the mind, so that we're kind of spinning around in there. And it's said one of the things is praise does that. And the opposite, blame does that. And maybe most of you understand how blame oscillates your mind, but you don't understand how praise does it, because that just feels good, right? Mm-hmm. But that also can agitate the mind, getting praise and blame. You can be caught in that game, going back and forth. And some people will circle around those. The other two extremes that I sometimes talk about is success and failure. And we're caught by success or caught by failure. And the mind gets agitated, gets aroused, loses its equanimity and its calm. And even with wonderful things like success and praise, which can be nice to have, and sometimes they're for good reason to have them, if the mind loses its equanimity, loses its balance, then it becomes a setup to suffer often later. Like if you lose your balance around success, it goes to your head. You get proud, you get arrogant, and then it's a setup for when next time there's a failure that you know you're used to, you know, you're not used to that, or you kind of built yourself up. If you lose your balance with getting praise, you get puffed up also or something, right? If you lose your balance, if you get criticized, then we feel dejected or something. So how do we keep our balance in the middle of these kinds of extremes when they happen? There's two more dyads, pairs. One is pleasure and pain, or comfort and discomfort. Is another thing which can cause the mind to lose its balance, push us over the edge. We feel some discomfort and we get excited about that. We get discouraged. We get agitated about how things are. Or we feel a lot of comfort, and it's possible to lose one's balance with getting too much pleasure and wonderful things. And it's a setup for suffering some other way. And maybe I shouldn't say this, and maybe someone afterwards will tell me I should never talk this way again. But it's a kind of thing, you know, where, you know, back in the golden age when I was a kid, kind of, you know, you shouldn't talk that way, right? So back in the golden age, you know, one of the reasons to go and practice in Asia is not is because of the level of discomfort meditators have to experience retreats in there. You go to the monasteries there, and there's very few monasteries which are, you know, state-of-the-art, you know, meditation centers like we have in here in America, where we spend millions of dollars to build Spirit Rock or Mount Madonna or IMS or the Forest Refuge or these different retreat centers around. And they're very comfortable. And what happens when you go to Asia to practice in uncomfortable situations, even if you have no good meditation experiences, it can be character building. You know, you get used to it. You kind of are faced with your, you know, how you're caught by your preferences, your likes and dislikes, your expectations that things be a certain way and they work a certain way. And after a while, you kind of get used to it all. You can't expect them to be the way you want them to be. Or you realize how much you suffer because you have preferences. And maybe it's okay not to have a preference. And maybe it's, you know, you realize after a few months of sleeping on a wooden bed with no mattress that, you know, it's possible to do this. And your anger, your irritation, and impatience kind of eventually kind of fades away. You know, after a while, you don't have, you know, much juice for that kind of activity anymore, and you get used to it. And when I came back to America after doing that for, I had 8 months on a wooden plank, in a meditation monastery in Asia, one of the greatest monasteries in Asia, one of the best ones. They gave me a wooden plank to sleep on. So I came back here and came back to San Francisco Zen Center, and I'd been gone for a while. And so they put me in a guest room, which was very kind of plush. And there was this very plush bed, very, very soft mattress and big down comforter. And I looked at that. I just couldn't get myself to sleep in it. So I slept on the rug, on the floor next to it, because that was a lot, certainly softer than the wood. But that only lasted one night. But then you have all this, you know, a lot of comfort. It's very easy to lose your balance when little things go wrong. And I've seen people go to Spirit Rock, which is so plush compared. And little things go wrong, and people get so upset. The thermostat doesn't work, so the room is a little bit too hot. You know, it's very common. And people expect to have a high. There's one person who showed up at Spirit Rock for a retreat. And left right away because if I'm going to pay $35 a night for a room, it should at least be like the Hilton or something. And then the last thing that we can lose our balance with, the eight worldly winds, is fame and infamy. A little bit different than praise and blame. Being famous or being caught by fame or infamy. A lot of famous people suffer when they're no longer famous. And they don't recognize how they've lost their balance when they're famous because it feels so great. But when the fame drops away, then they notice how much they've tipped one, you know, the pendulum has swung. So the Buddha said in a verse, as a solid mass of rock is like a mountain, a solid rock, a mass of rock is not stirred by the wind, so a sage is not moved by praise and blame. As a deep lake is clear and undisturbed, so a sage becomes clear upon hearing the Dharma. Virtuous people always let go. They don't prattle about pleasures and desires. Touched by happiness and then by suffering, the sage shows no sign of being elated or depressed. Such a person who, like the earth, is untroubled, who is like a lake without mud, continues wandering no more. Now here's a good one. I like this one because, next verse, because I think upon hearing it, all of you will feel a little bit more equanimous. I hope. You better. Or I won't be. They find fault in one sitting silently. They find fault in one speaking much. They find fault in one speaking in moderation. No one in this world is not found at fault. There has been, there is, and there will be no person who is only criticized or only praised. Doesn't that help? It's a setup, right? Life is a setup. You can't do it right. Someone will criticize you. And if you know that, then, you know, like your four-year-old says, I hate you. It's not such a pleasant thing to hear. But, you know, 5 minutes earlier, they said they want to marry you. You know, I think a certain amount of equanimity is called for. One of the primary, perhaps my suggestion is one of the primary causes for losing our equanimity can be when we take things personally, that we use it as a way of defining who we are. Someone praises us and we take it personally. Oh, this says something about me, and we get puffed up. We have failure and we take it personally. Oh, this is terrible. I failed. So all kinds of ways in which we somehow identify with the experience, make it mine, me, my, myself in relationship to the experience. So the Buddha said, the person for whom there is no making into mine anything in the realm of body and mind, and who doesn't grieve what doesn't exist, is called a bhikkhu, called a monk. The person for whom there is no making into mine. And it's relatively common for meditators to discover at some point the kind of shift that happens when you have something, an experience, like say it's pain, usually it's with pain, or some emotional pain, and you're feeling some discomfort like that, and they feel a shift between seeing the pain as my pain versus the pain. And feeling how things lighten up a little bit, we don't take it personally. We don't identify it with, don't say, you know, this is happening to me in some, it is happening to me, you know, it's not like we're not denying that, but the mind has all this extra stuff that goes on, contraction, when the mind makes this is mine, this is, and it loses, it's very easy to lose its balance that way. And the last verse, peaceful in body, peaceful in speech, the monk who is peaceful and well concentrated and who has rejected the world's bait is called one at peace. It's a very strong statement to have rejected the world's bait. Do you know the world has bait? It's trying to bait you. All you have to do is go out on 101, Highway 101, and there's bait. They're poised on the billboards waiting for you, trying to bait you, trying to get you hooked. And it's just rampant in our society, the way in which people are trying to bait us. Pop up advertisements in our computer, right? It's a little bait. They're trying to get us. You know, there's all these ways. And I've noticed some of the magazines, like I've seen, like Newsweek. I've seen Newsweek many years ago, and I've seen Newsweek nowadays. And now they have this whole section often, like they call it like, I don't know what they call it, like technology section. And it's all about these great products they want you to buy, the reviewing products. And they're just, you know, they're just trying to help you be better consumers, encouraging us to be consumers. The bait has been set. You're being helped. You know, hopefully you bite. But are there other forms of bait besides the kind of bait where people are trying to grab you, trying to get your attention, trying to, you know, and there's certainly a bait that, you know, we bite on sensual pleasures. We bite on all kinds of things. The mind loses its balance because we want or we don't want. We pushing away, holding on to things. So a lot of what mindfulness practice involves is beginning to appreciate all the ways in which the mind gets agitated, all the ways in which the mind bites or gets hooked or reacts, and to meet that with equanimity, to be equanimous about it. The way that Vipassana, mindfulness practice, is taught in America is taught, according to traditional Buddhist psychology, technical psychology, where we teach mindfulness is we teach it in together with equanimity. Because we talk about mindfulness being a non-reactive awareness of what's happening. And what's actually happening is we've brought two elements together. Mindfulness and, in a sense, mindfulness and equanimity. And there's an attempt to try to meet our experience with some level of equanimity, not to be reactive to what's there. And of course, it's very interesting when you find yourself being reactive. Then the task is to judge yourself bitterly for being reactive, right? For not being a good Buddhist, right? No. The task then is to be equanimous about your lack of equanimity. To somehow try to hold it in a bigger embrace, to be more accepting of it or more open, or not to get imbalanced because you're imbalanced. Because then you'll suffer more. Then you really be pushed over the edge. So is equanimity a dull, flat, uninteresting thing to develop? Probably most of you will say no. It's not dull and uninteresting, but it's not juicy. It's not exciting, like some things can be exciting. Here are some descriptions of a mind that's filled with equanimity. A mind imbued with equanimity, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That's quite a strong set of descriptions. Abundant, exalted, and immeasurable. It's a very powerful state when equanimity is really well developed as a meditation practice. There was one more description. So on attaining a very deep level of equanimity, there remains only equanimity, pure and bright, pliant, malleable, and luminous. Just as if a skilled goldsmith were to prepare a furnace, heat up a crucible, and taking gold with a pair of tongs, placed it in the crucible. He would blow on it, sprinkle water on it, examine it, so that the gold would become refined, well refined, thoroughly refined, flawless, free from dross, pliant, malleable, and luminous. Then whatever sort of ornament he had in mind, it would serve his purpose. In the same way, there remains only equanimity, pure and bright, pliant, malleable, and luminous. So that's not a very dull state, is it? A flat state? This is a very brilliant state. And it turns out that one of the most sublime, or the most sublime, one of the deepest states to attain along the Buddhist path is the state of equanimity. Equanimity is considered, deep state of equanimity is considered the springboard to awakening, to becoming free in this tradition here. Or this is one of the ways to become free, is to have the mind so equanimous, so balanced, that it can almost like it's you know it's so balanced that in Zen they talk about the bottom dropping out of the bucket. When it's completely balanced, then there's nothing holding the bottom; it just drops out. And so you find in a lot of the lists, practice lists in Buddhism, equanimity appears last in the lists. And interestingly, in the list of the 10 paramis, the 10 perfections, equanimity is the last one. Number 9 is loving kindness. And it's said that equanimity perfects loving kindness. Isn't that beautiful? Unless you have some equanimity, some balance of mind in relationship to others, you can't really perfect your love for other people, your loving kindness. It's said also in the as a parami that equanimity is accompanied by compassion, and compassion is accompanied by equanimity. So it has a very important role together with being compassionate. In the 7 factors of awakening, equanimity is one of the things that's sometimes said to balance the other 6. So these wonderful qualities that come into play as a person gets deeply into practice. Mindfulness, investigation, effort, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And the analogy given is that of 6 horses being pulled by a carriage being pulled by 6 horses. And if some of the horses are pulling ahead further, or some of the horses are lagging behind, they don't really run very well. And so you need to have a good charioteer, whatever it's called, a horseman, who is getting the horses running just balanced and perfect together in tandem. So the role of equanimity is to bring into balance these other factors. So mindfulness and investigation and effort and joy, tranquility, concentration are all working in tandem in a balanced way. It's, as I said, the 4th one in the Brahmaviharas, in these are divine abodes, the 4th of the kind of forms of love we can have to other people. And interestingly, the way to cultivate the equanimity as a Brahmavihara is to have some understanding, some wisdom about who is responsible for suffering, for a person's suffering. To understand the degree to which people make their own choices and decisions. And we can't make choices and decisions for people. And so the kind of hook of feeling responsible for other people is lessened when we realize that even if I have other wishes for you, I'm trying to do the best to help you, you're still making those decisions on your own that are causing you more suffering. I'm sorry about that, but that's your decision. Some sense of the way it's technically talked about is beings are inherit their own karma. Everyone inherits their own karma. So that sense of gives kind of a balance of mind. If you leave people alone with their responsibility, and maybe that probably wasn't a good way of saying it, but it brings a balance of mind when we realize that it's not up to us to save the other person. We might try to be helpful and be compassionate in all kinds of ways, but if the person makes choices which are not wise, that's really, their choices, and if not get pulled in by that, brings equanimity, a certain kind of balance of mind. Here are some of the kind of phrases people use for equanimity practice. You are the owner of your own karma. Your outcome depends on your actions and not my wishes. No matter how I might wish things to be otherwise, things are as they are. Although I wish only the best for you, I also know that your happiness and unhappiness depends on your actions, not my wishes for you. So there are many different kinds of equanimity. talked about in the tradition. And what might be interesting now is to spend a little bit of time talking about what supports equanimity, the conditions that allow equanimity to be here for us, so we can meet the world with greater equanimity, since it is a very important quality to have, that balance of mind. It's to go through kind of the sequence that they would go through in the traditional texts. The first thing that would support equanimity is your virtue, is your integrity. To be able to live a life that's blameless, where you feel confident about your actions, your behavior, your words, so that you don't have to feel agitated when you encounter someone or you think about what you said, brings a kind of equanimity. In the ancient texts, they talk about being able to go into an assembly of people and feel blameless. And so there's no reason to be agitated or concerned, excited, because you're blameless. You haven't done anything that anyone has any reason to blame you for. So to cultivate a life of integrity is a foundation for equanimity. Another foundation for equanimity is I'm missing the second one now. Some people here on Friday, remember the second one in the list we had? Virtue. Oh, faith. Faith. Faith is a very important quality. Faith or trust or conviction. If you have a lot of faith, that gives you a sense of understanding of what's happening, a sense of order, a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning in what's going on, that's sometimes larger than just the details of what's happening or details of your preferences or likes and dislikes. That can let the mind be much more relaxed and less reactive of what's going on. Now, of course, all kinds of faith can provide equanimity. Even faith which is based on, you know, something which is false, as long as you have some strong understanding. If you believe that when you die, little green Martians are going to come and take you to this wonderful, you know, green palace on Mars where everything's going to be, you know, dandy, just fine. You can die with a lot of equanimity because, great, that sounds good, right? And are there little people on Mars who are going to come and take us away? I don't know. But faith can provide. And there's some things which are, you know, better things to have faith in than others, but faith can provide a lot of equanimity. In the Buddhist tradition, we talk about conviction or confidence. So if you have confidence, for example, in your own ability to engage in a practice, to understand this, to work with it, to process what's going on, then that can bring a lot more equanimity because you know you have the skills for dealing with it. If you have... So faith or confidence or conviction can be very helpful. I know for myself that I have a little bit more equanimity than I used to have because of my tremendous confidence in the practice of mindfulness. And so in situations where in the past I would have been caught by them and lose my balance, I still might not know, you know, how to respond or how to act, but I trust the process of mindfulness, of waking up and being present for what's going on. And as I'm present, things seem to kind of move. If I'm present and really aware, they process. Another thing that can bring equanimity is a well-developed mind. A mind which is concentrated, a mind which has developed itself, but developed its mindfulness, developed its ability to apply itself, developed its stability of mind, its ability to focus. It's kind of like a strength. A concentrated mind is kind of like a mind which is strong. Like if you go and work out in the gym and get strong, then you're not going to be buffeted around as easily by some of the things that might make you more imbalanced. And same thing, if you develop your strength of your mind, the mind is not so easily pushed around. And we know this because when people go off to do something that's challenging, like give a public talk and they're nervous about it, sometimes people will meditate first or breathe or do something that brings the mind, makes the mind calm. And when the mind is calm, you're less likely to be buffeted about. So to cultivate calmness or concentration is a foundation for equanimity. Another foundation for equanimity is understanding or wisdom. So to understand, for example, have the wisdom about how other people are the owners of their own karma, how other people, that part of other people's lives where they're responsible for their own decisions, And even though you might have wish the best for them or are involved trying to helping them, you're not going to be caught by their hooks. You're not going to be hooked by their choices they have to make. You let them, okay, I'm offering you the best conditions I can, but this is your choice that you have to make. There is a whole range of kind of deeper understandings we can about, for example, understanding other people. This is maybe connected to compassion. There are situations where we might get angry when someone does something towards us, but when we have a different perspective of why they did what they did, then the irritation, the anger can drop away, and we're much more equanimous, maybe even compassionate about that person, that person's actions. Maybe we understand something about the nature of their suffering. We say, wow, that, I didn't know that person was suffering so much, even though what the person did was not good. Boy, now that I understand the depth of that person's suffering, you know, I'm not going to be so caught and so reactive about you know, what the person did. So understanding can change the context, change the perspective. And part of mindfulness practice is to not take your initial perspective for granted, or and to actually massage it, look at it. And are there other perspectives here? Is this the only perspective? On what authority do I have this perspective as being the right one? And then another foundation for mindfulness, for equanimity, is insight itself. And insight is a little bit different than understanding or wisdom, though they can overlap. Because insight is a kind of a deep seeing into the nature of how things are. And one of the primary ones is seeing into the nature of impermanence. To really see things that are always passing, arising and passing, can provide a tremendous amount of equanimity to people. So much so that there's a Sufi story about the man who came to the teacher and said, inscribe on my ring some piece of wisdom that I can look at periodically and help me in my life. And so the master wrote on the ring, this too will pass. And this has been very helpful as a parent of a young child. This little piece of wisdom, this too will pass. You know, and if I hadn't had that in mind, when I don't have that in mind, I'm much more likely to be caught by the drama. Because there's a way in which my psyche, and I suspect some other psyches also, well, sometimes has this, even though I know it's not the case, but unconsciously or subconsciously, or there's this kind of working assumption that's behind the scenes, this is it. It's permanent. I'm angry. This is terrible. I'm just an angry person. I'll be angry forever. I'm depressed. This weighs away forever. My kid is obnoxious. This is the way it is. I have to deal with an obnoxious kid now for the next, you know, decades. This too will pass. This is going through, you know, and having some understanding about phases of life, and, you know, kids go through phases, and they talk about, you know, periods of equilibrium and disequilibrium for kids and grown-ups. And to have some sense of these patterns, you know, it can bring a lot more equanimity. And like that time my wife looked at me and said to me, we were having difficulty with our son, and she said, we're having one of those days. And that just kind of, my mind became balanced again. Oh, it's just one of those days. I wish it was always that easy. So, but understanding that things pass, things change, can bring a lot of equanimity, though sometimes it brings agitation. Oh, this is going to pass. This person's going to leave me. This person's dying. Or things will pass. In the deepest forms of insight, we realize that things are changing so quickly that we can't really hold on to anything in the way we think they're there. And so when we really see that we can't hold on to anything in the way we think that's really, that we think it's there, the mind has no choice eventually. I guess it has choice. That's why we suffer. But sooner or later, you realize you have to let go of everything. 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 And this letting go of everything brings a kind of deep equanimity. And the final equanimity is the equanimity of freedom. And this is the kind of equanimity that comes when you have no buttons to be pushed. Your tendency to be reactive, to be caught, no longer operates inside of you. And I believe all of you probably have some sense of that. You've had some experience of that. Probably most of you in this room, if you got a zit on your cheek today, you'd be able, that's not a big button, is it, for you? Though when you were 14, was it a bigger button? I know it was for me, going to school with a zit. And so some things, you know, you've been liberated from. And the whole thrust of traditional Buddhist practice is to increase or expand the range of life, the range of experience that you're free in relationship to. So it's not just zits, but actually much more profound things, like yourself. So I'll end with one more quote from the Buddha. And this is an instruction for developing meditation on equanimity. And this is a little touching, kind of a little bit touching little quote, because it comes from a discourse that preserves a time when the Buddha was giving teaching to his son. And his son, at some point, became a monk also, or a novice monk. So he became a novice, joined the order relatively young. And here he's talking to his young son and giving him teachings about developing equanimity. Develop meditation that is like the earth. For then, agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions will not take charge of your mind. Just as when people throw what is clean and unclean on the earth, feces, urine, saliva, pus, or blood, the earth is not horrified, humiliated, or disgusted by it. In the same way, agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions will not take charge of your mind when you develop meditation like the earth. So may you consider equanimity for this next week. I'd encourage you to reflect on it and think about it, explore it. Appreciate all the ways which you're not equanimous. If you understand the forces of lack of equanimity, it's actually one of the primary ways of developing more equanimity. May it be that your family, your colleagues, your neighbors, your community all benefit from your equanimity.